Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 15 of Season 5 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off Week 3 is Niall McGowan of the Bat Minute. Na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Welcome back, Niall.
What, is this some kind of tag team?
Well, maybe we'll talk about tag teams. You never know. The problem is that the only other dialogue here for me to even say something is,
This minute, like what a moment to cut at the end of this minute. It was just like to see.
Yes, that's true. That's right. The way that he just, it looks like one of those, 80s shows where, they just like freeze frame at the end. Looked that way, just like someone jumping and screaming.
I think it would have been like a split second before or after, it would have looked more dignified, but it's just the frozen image of Bruce going,
like, correct. That's true.
Made the begin jump is incredible.
That's right. So minute 15 begins with a tiger shark passing by and ends with John screaming like a banshee.
I have to do it.
There we go.
So a tiger shark, a what? That has to be done. And every mention of a tiger shark since 1975, someone in the room has gone, oh, what? I'm just hoping that the audience gets what the reference is there.
But... why don't you explain it to everybody?
What's this from that one guy in Jaws when those random guys think like, oh, we caught the shark, and they got it over the dock, and then they're told it's not, and then Richard Dreyfuss is kind of standing nearby, and they're like, well, what the hell is this then? And Richard Dreyfuss goes, a tiger shark. And there's just this really heavy set guy who you're expecting to have a much gruffer voice. And he just turns and goes, a what? And it just cuts to the next scene. But it's just a really, really funny moment because you're just not expecting that voice to come out of that guy.
That's true. So, yes.
I know there's been several Jaws minutes, and I've not been on any of them, but if I was to be on any of them, if there's future Jaws minutes coming down the line, I will definitely have to call the...
Jaws is actually a movie that about 6 months ago, I finally got to see in the theater, and it was...
Oh, really?
I was so happy. I happened to see, here in Israel, we don't get that many, reshowings of older movies. It's very rare. And I was shocked that within the last 6 months, there were actually three. And I saw two out of the three. So we had Jaws, which I made sure to go see. Most of the showings were at like midnight, but I found like a 7:30 p.m. showing that I finally was able to go see. And it was on an IMAX screen also, which was great. I mean, I've seen the movie tons of times, but, to see it in the screen. The problem is that most of the people in the theater just didn't appreciate it. There was like this father and daughter who were sitting in front of me. And when they got up, they looked at each other at the end of the movie and they both go, that was a terrible movie. And I just had to like bite my tongue there instead of saying to them, you just don't know anything about movies.
I find that impossible. I've rewatched Jaws in the last couple of years. And it was just like at the end of it, I was like, yep, that was everything I remember. It was as good as I remember that being.
Exactly.
Like, it's literally like a perfect film. I can't imagine anybody having any beef with it. Like,
seriously. Well, people who don't appreciate movies, I guess.
Yeah.
And
that's something we could do for like budgetary reasons too. Like, I know maybe people are now used to like special effects extravaganzas for the climax, but like, maybe. This is considering the hell they went through to make it, and it's like, well, it's a malfunctioning freaking rubber shark. It looks great. I don't see what the problem is. But.
It's true. Then they also had a release of E.T., which I unfortunately didn't get a chance to see because every showing was at 2 p.m. I was like, I just couldn't find a day that really works for me as well.
I guess it was like a Spielberg season or something? Or was it just they randomly happened?
No, I guess it was just random. I don't think that it was specifically about Spielberg. And then the third one was when they had the re-release of Titanic. And that one, I convinced my wife to actually go see that one with me. And we'd seen the movie together. I mean, I saw it when it came out, and it's something I watch once or twice a year because I love Titanic. I think it's such a great, amazing movie. I have a lot more to say about Jim Cameron, but the movie itself to me is a near perfect movie, and I can just watch it over and over. And I was like, getting to see that in the theater again, why not? And I was like, I said to my wife, I said, let's go see it, and she's like, isn't that like a 3-hour movie? And I'm like, yeah, but let's go. And she's like, fine. And
it's one of the 3-hour movies that is like, no, it needs the 3 hours. Like,
exactly.
It's like Like a solid hour, that is complete carnage, and all that's great. Yes, but you need, for sure. You need 2 hours of proper character stuff to make you care about the stuff on the other end as well. So
yeah, and the greatest thing about it was after we saw the movie, my wife turned to me and says, "Wow, this was amazing." And I was like, "You see?"
Yeah,
she doesn't like movies as much as I do, but still, you know.
I've recently rewatched Titanic myself too, because I was recently on Titanic Talk Line. There's a lady, Alexia, is just doing a show, not just about Titanic, the movie, but just about the Titanic in general. Because I live, I grew up near Belfast, which is where the Titanic was built, and I've been to the Titanic Museum loads of times and stuff. I could talk that, but I did rewatch the movie to prepare to go on. And it was a movie I always remember being like, yeah, Titanic's pretty good. And it was just for some, whatever reason was, this last time. I don't know if it was all the hoopla of James Cameron, but out with Avatar 2 going like, technical advancements and all, I need these special effects to be ready, and I've been like, whatever. And then to see the special effects he did in 1997 for Titanic, and during that, like when the boats, you know, when everything's going crazy, and it's all done mostly practically, you're kind of going, Jim, what you did here is friggin' phenomenal. Like, all your CGI stuff I don't care about. This is what filmmaking is right here. And you already did it like 25 years ago, man. Like, what are you pushing yourself for?
See, that's the problem. Some people just want to always try and top themselves.
Yeah.
And, fair though, he's able to. I saw Avatar 2. I saw it the day it came out, and I was mesmerized. It's not a 3-hour-and-12-minute movie that deserves to be 3 hours and 12 minutes. You know, there are a few lulls in the, you know, in the story, which was my one complaint about it. But I mean, visually, it was such an amazing movie, and it was great seeing it in the theater.
So
I can't really complain about that.
As mentioned, though, if there's no moments of what's his name, the Sam Worthington, of him like trying to fight off Stephen Graham in a big mechanized suit and going like, how could the same happen to the same guy twice? I'm going to be thoroughly disappointed. I can assure you of that.
Well, he doesn't say it, but it does happen. Yes.
Yeah. Just them chasing off the invading humans in the end. And, you know, Michelle Rodriguez going like, why does this always happen to us? But, there's lines I have beef with in Die Hard 2. That was one of them.
Yeah, but they had to put that in there. You know, I'm glad that in the subsequent movies they took those out. But at least this time, you know, it was fun to see it. They just did it too much in this movie.
Yeah, and another line I don't care for is actually in this minute. So as well, like, actually, it's the only line in this minute, really. but we'll get
there. We'll get there. So you know, just to recap. John is right now in the middle of a firefight in the luggage compartment area of the airport, with all of these conveyor belts going, moving in all different directions with all different sized luggage around there. Lots of places to find different types of weapons or things to shoot at. You know, it's a good target practice place, I guess you could say. And then John ended up losing his gun in yesterday's minute. And, you know, he's trying to figure out what he's going to do to counterattack or defend himself against both Cochran and Miller. And then a Tiger Shark golf bag moves across the, you know, the conveyor belt in front of his eyes. And you see his eyes like light up.
Yeah, as well as like Tiger Shark. I understand that's the leading golf club brand in the U.S. currently.
Yeah, I mean, I actually tried looking it up, but I don't know if they still manufacture them. I couldn't find a website with Tiger Shark.
Well, I also looked it up and was quite amused to find the first page of Google was mostly just eBay listings.
Yes,
from people
exactly.
People getting rid of Tiger.
People selling old carry bags and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then there was a link to a Reddit discussion where someone was like, is Tiger Shark any good? And all the answers were like, no. So there might be a reason that you can't find any current Tiger Shark
website.
Just because they went out of their only spokesperson was Die Hard 2.
Well, I found a website, but it's like it looks like a really old website, and nothing really – there was no information that was really good on that website. You know, like the company website, but – you know, I guess someone.
We still know that when they were trying to go out for product placement, though, and they're like, "What about the Tiger Shark golf people?" And then like the Tiger Shark people have been like, "Is Die Hard 2 set on a golf course? Like, what's happening? Like, how can he hide? Like, what was? It's just Bruce Willis running around in a big green circle where everybody can see each other all the time.
Yeah, it's true. All right, but I first want to talk about the conveyor belts, right? So when do you think someone invented the modern use of conveyor belts?
You know, that's got to be like a 19... Like, oh, I'd say that probably goes back quite a way, like 1910, maybe, thereabouts?
1892.
Oh, I got close. That's 1892. The closest I've been this whole week, I think.
Yeah, there was a man named Thomas Robbins who continued to. He had a whole bunch of small inventions that eventually led to the conveyor belt, and because he was using it to be able to carry coal and ore and other products, you know, to help with mining, basically. Then they started creating steel conveyor belts in the early 1900s, 1901. And in 1905, they had even larger ones that would work much more efficiently. In 1913, Henry Ford introduced conveyor belt assembly lines at his Michigan Ford Motor Company factory. Huh? And I mean, it's just amazing the fact of how this small little idea has become something that's so amazing. That they, I mean,
it's literally like if you go into like any supermarket these days, there will be several conveyor belts on the premises.
That's correct.
Like, there just needs to be.
Yeah, that's right. Now, what do you think the longest conveyor belt in the world is? How long do you think it is? The longest?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Because again, it's been used for mining and stuff like that, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah. So you're probably going to go ones that are going way into mountains and stuff like that. Yeah, sure. I don't know. I dare not hazard a guess because I'm sure it's probably going to be something insane.
It is. It's completely insane. The largest conveyor belt in the world is in the Western Sahara. It was built in 1972. All right. And it is 98 kilometers, 61 miles long.
Wow.
And it's it's used in the phosphate mines of Bukra coast south of El Aoun.
Yeah. Well, like, is it still functioning? Is it still from 1972?
As far as I know, it's still functioning. Now, what is the longest conveyor system in an airport? Because again, this is what we're dealing with here. System, not necessarily, because again, it could be going in zigzag fashion or whatever it is. But the,
I don't know. I'll go LAX because I remember that being one of the answers yesterday. So like maybe they've LA is very flat. Maybe they think, oh, we don't do crisscross. We do everything's flat and everything's across a massive wide space.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're in the wrong part of the world. I'm sorry to say, it's in Dubai International Airport. Okay, and how long do you think that conveyor system is?
2 miles, something like that.
63 kilometers, which is the equivalent of 39 miles.
Wow. Holy moly.
Yep.
I was thinking if you lose your bag on that. Oh boy.
That's great.
It's gonna be a time.
Yeah, I mean these are just amazing lengths that you wouldn't even think of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
I enjoy again this whole setup though, because this I have to check actually what year it came out specifically.
1990.
Because this all I'm thinking of did you ever see Child's Play 2?
I'm not much of a horror person. I've seen Child's Play. I don't think I saw Child's Play 2.
They're all
pretty much the same.
Varying degrees. pretty good. Oh, actually, no. So the Child's Play 2 is also 1990, but the climax of Child's Play 2 is probably the best climax of the whole. Like the whole saga or whatever, but it's inside the Good Guy Doll factory where it looks very much like this, only it's a bit more brightly lit and I've just got like Good Guy Dolls everywhere and stuff, but it turns into things. I'm like, well, what can we do with this? It's like, well, people are getting trapped on the conveyor belts and getting like doll eyes shoved in over their own eyes and stuff, and Chucky himself at one point gets like trapped on a thing and put into some kind of weird melting mold thing, so he comes out as a kind of Cronenbergian sort of, you know, melted pile of plastic flesh goo and stuff like that. It gets really, really crazy. It gets like a hose shoved in his mouth at one point. The pulls him up in the air and he explodes and he keeps coming because it's freaking Chucky and stuff. But it really, really reminded me of this. It's just like, it's full of like zigzaggy conveyor belts all over the place and people riding them and hopping from place to place and stuff. It's a really, really good set piece. But it's weird that it's also out the same year. There must have been a thing around the time of like,
I wonder if it's the same company. You know, I wonder if they said, oh, well, we have this that we made for Child's Play, or we have this thing that we made for Die Hard 2. Why don't we just, you know, use it in both?
Yeah. It's like, well, just one you just light like a normal room, and one you light like a carbonite freezing chamber.
That's right.
Although this is 20th Century Fox, right? But the Child's Play distributed by Universal. So I don't know. Maybe they both got it in a deal or something. But
Yeah, could be.
Or
both of them spent a hell of a lot of money on conveyor belts.
Yeah. It'd be great though, at one point you see like John McClane going past and then Chucky's coming on the other conveyor belt. And, like, they're just going to lock eyes. Like, wait a minute. What the hell's happening here?
That's right. Then he picks up the doll and throws Chucky at Miller. There you go.
Yeah.
You know, that would help. That would end things much quicker with
Miller. Speaking of Steven Spielberg, that's like literally a move in Ready Player One. I remember sort of rolling my eyes at things like that because they're just like, yeah, he just like all the IP are having a fight, and one of them just throws Chucky at another guy because Chucky does kill people.
Right.
I think I was like hung up in that movie where like they were using the Iron Giant to fight.
Yeah,
and it's like, have you seen the Iron Giant? Do you get what that movie's about? Like, they're like, no, he's like a big nuclear powered.
But it's an avatar,
right? It's like, nah, you lost me here, Spielberg. You lost me here. But oh well. Yeah. Remember how good Jaws was? It was great.
That's right. So yeah, we then see, you know, the golf bag, the tiger shark moves to the side, and then we see Miller continuing to creep along, you know, looking around for McClane. And you can see in the background, this is something I mentioned earlier this week, you know, those, that electrical equipment that they have it behind him, you know, you can once again see NEA listed on it, which I'm like, once again, why did they have to have everything say NEA on it? You know, Northeast Airlines, I don't know. You know, because it's all fictional. If it was a real one, I can say, okay, fine. You know, but they actually had to go and put those stickers on there, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think then if it was a real company, you'd roll your eyes even more, though, because it would be such blatant product placement.
That's like, right. But that's the thing. It's product placement, like... it's product placement for something that's fake.
That's... Yeah. I'd go easy on that though, because it's like, well, I remember watching episodes of Poker Face recently, like the new Natasha Lyonne show, and it's great. But there's like an episode set entirely in a subway, where like there's a guy wearing a Subway T-shirt and has an apron on top of that says Subway, and he also has a hat that says Subway, and behind him is a giant Subway sign. It's just like, you're lucky this show is so good, because goddamn, I would turn it off out of principle right now if this wasn't a high quality production. But if it was a fake sandwich place, I'd be like, oh, whatever, go ahead, you know, whatever you got to do.
Okay, that is fair. I agree with you on that one. And then you can see that Miller is very nervous because he's sweating. You know, goes back to what we were saying earlier this week, that these are supposed to be trained military men, but he is still, you know, he's out of his element, I guess, because usually he doesn't fight in the baggage compartment, I guess.
Yes, he just kind of clearly wasn't in. He must be recent. He wasn't in Nam. If he had been out in the jungle, he would be used to something like that.
Well, he's old enough. The actor Vondi Curtis Hall is old enough to have been in Vietnam.
He's having flashbacks. He might be more like, oh Christ, this really reminds me now of like all this, like the steaming Delta. Like, you know, this is the enemy's up. I can't tell where he is. He could be, you know, he's up in the rafters somewhere. Maybe he's giving him flashbacks, and that's why he's so like, oh God.
That's an interesting idea. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
That's very possible.
I'm quite happy too, as someone who hosts a show about Batman, because it's very like, this is very Batman Begins of like, you know, him going into the basement of Arkham and like the Scarecrow like going, it's the Batman, and like looking up to see if we can see him somewhere and stuff. But
yeah,
but sadly, like John McClane won't even wear like a Clint Eastwood-esque poncho in this shot. He's just sitting. He's not got the cool theatrics of Batman. He's just there in his beige jumper.
That's right. It's true. And you know, as Miller's walking around, we see that he's surprised by John, who uses a golf club against him because you know, we had a little bit of a hint at the beginning of this minute that that's what he was going to be doing. He decided to take a golf club. I mean, for me, it's very strange that someone would check in their golf clubs. Wouldn't it at some point, like, you know, if wouldn't the golf clubs fall out of the bag as it's on the conveyor belts? Because the conveyor belts do go up and down and things like that, you know, and even if you think about it, when it comes out, you know, when you're waiting for at the carousel, you know, you don't know which side it's going to be coming from.
So I wonder if they have, they might have, for the reasons of like the visual cues in the film, they had to be like, well, maybe in real life, someone would like zip up the top of the bag. So that would not happen.
That's very possible.
But you can't just have a tiger shark bag going past. People are like, what the hell's that? So we had the bag open, then people go like, oh, it's golf clubs. And then that's where he got the thing is, I don't think you even need to like signify to people like there's golf clubs going past. If John McClane just shows up with some golf clubs, you're going to be like, oh, he obviously took them off the conveyor belt. Like it's not rocket science, you know, but it's a, and then two of had it been the ski that you said that was originally supposed to be scripted as being a ski pole. Like, what would that have been in a bag as well? Or would it have been, like, loose ski poles just lying on a conveyor belt? How would that have looked?
Yeah. No, I don't know. I mean, I did a search for, you know, if about the rules if you want to, you know, check in your golf clubs on a plane.
That's a... I don't know, because I'm still thinking of, like, you know... You definitely wouldn't want to bring them on the plane with you.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. But, you know, like, for instance, they say that most airlines treat golf clubs as standard luggage, meaning that there's a weight limit, but no oversized baggage fee. And if your clubs go missing, they will replace them. You know, but obviously it deals with a lot of paperwork if need be. But if it's damaged, they won't necessarily, most airlines will not compensate you for them because it's your fault for the way you packed it. Yeah.
And I mean, like, there's gonna be some paperwork filled out after, like, well, my golf club was in the shape of some sort of terrorist goon. It was bent around, like it has been bent around some guy's head for a second.
That's right. And many of the airlines actually tell you what you're allowed to have in this golf bag. You can have, you know, clubs, balls, tees, one pair of shoes, and things like that. And if they find that you've hidden other things in the golf bag, you know, you can get charged extra fees and things like that.
It's hearing things like this is why, like, the flashbacks as to why I only pack light. Like, if I was going on a golfing trip, I'd be like, I'll just rent some clubs when I get there, like, rather than haul these things across. Unless it's like it could be, to be fair, maybe it's like freaking, you know, professional golfers or something are going around here, but like.
Correct. They say make sure you fly direct because you don't want to lose your you know golf bag along the way. And the problem is you should be careful that you don't have souvenirs or things with sentimental value within it because you know if it gets lost you're in for a lot of trouble. Make sure that you.
I mean, I can imagine so.
Make sure you use something that's high quality.
It seems like it seems like an ordeal, and it turns out it is an ordeal for whoever owns these golf clubs. So, yes. Because this is although it would say that, you know, the amount of complaints you get about American Airlines, it might be more like, we would have lost them anyway. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's like, true. No, actually,
quite frankly, it's shocking that you found them damaged.
Yeah,
like when they showed up, it's like, well, you got them at all. You should count as a blessing.
Well, whoever these sticks belong to, they will be, you know, missing at least one golf club.
That would have been great at the end, though. You see, like, William Atherton at, like, baggage claim, like, post-credits scene of William Atherton at baggage claim. Like, all his clothes have been, like, just lying around all over the floor. And then it's like, what the hell happened to my golf clubs?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, that wouldn't work because he's still on the plane. But, yeah, okay. Forget it.
That's post-credit. Exactly. Post-credit. You do the
Yeah, that's true. But so it's great the way that they do that, and you know, then they begin a little bit of a fight between the two of them. So Miller counters with a karate kick. John actually starts kicking him back. They start to punch one another back and forth, and then Miller kicks John in the leg, and he falls down. And then as soon as Miller gets ready once again to kick him, John grabs his shoulders you know, both of Miller's shoulders and pulls him towards him, smashing his head against like a metal beam that's on top of John, and then like he butt heads him afterwards. And then Miller falls on the ground, and he flies over some of the luggage. There's you know, someone now their bag has been damaged by this airline. They're, you know, be prepared to sue NEA, you know, for that, I guess. And as this
I'm
happens,
surprised that they keep it quite low key too with all the stuff that comes out.
yeah,
I'm surprised they're not like, you could, there's so many jokes you could
yeah,
throw
for
in for
sure,
things coming out of those
for
suitcases.
sure.
Like, no, let's refrain, let's just go, you know.
That's right.
It's just, you know, clothes
Yeah.
and anything that's hairspray, I
Right. Well,
guess.
not
But
yet. Not yet. First of all,
not yet.
we get a shot of the walkie-talkie flying, you know, flying across the ground, which you totally forget about, even though this will be mentioned later. You know, this is, you know, Chekhov's walkie-talkie. And you know, then Miller gets up and he picks a suitcase up and throws it at John, and then we see clothes fall all over the place. But you're right, I'm glad they just kept it at clothes and didn't show us anything else that could be coming out of someone's you know, luggage. And then
This
John
makes me think of the classic Fight Club scene of them, you know, Ed Norton trying to collect his bag that's supposed to be, you know, my bag was vibrating. It's like, oh, you know, sometimes it's a bomb, but most times it's a dildo.
That's right.
So it's like they could have done it. You know, it's a mere 9 years away from making the same joke,
That's
but
right. But I think the tone of this movie, it isn't a, it would be less appropriate in this movie to do that in the tone. You know, and then you know, then we see that John runs towards him, and then as Miller's getting ready to hit him again, John like sprays him with some sort of hairspray, you know, directly in his eyes, and he starts screaming, and you know, his eyes are burning. And as it's happening, the spray can, the aerosol can, just explodes in his hand. You know, you can see that you know, that then they show Cochran who just shot it. So my first thought is why did Cochran shoot? You know, if he's such a great shot, so the first thing you do is you shoot John in the head. That's also gonna stop him from spraying your friend in the face with a you know, with hairspray. And
Maybe it's because he's such a good shot. He's like, I want to show off. Like, shooting the guy is easy, but shooting that can from this distance, come
yeah,
on.
but
And then afterwards, he'd be saying, "Like, did you see it?" It's like, no, I was having my eyes were got freaking hairspray sprayed
I'm
in the face.
freaking blind. How did I see it?
Oh, I will give the Colonel Stewart's units a little bit more credit here over Hans Gruber's crew, because. You've been through the movie minute by minute. I think it's only really Carl in the first movie who's like a proper like fisticuffs. Who's a
Yes.
proper? Like, I know there's a physical altercation with Tony, but I think the rest of the crew they're all just
Right. Well, that
dummies.
didn't help with
Whereas like,
Tony.
Carl's the only guy who can actually like properly fight, you know.
With
So
Tony, the fisticuffs didn't really work for him. He wasn't a fisticuffs type of
but
guy.
so this movie's really it, you know, it does the sequel thing of really amping things up because you get a gunfight and then you're already in the McLean getting his ass whooped,
That's right.
like, you know, in hand-to-hand combat there, and it's still only what, minute 15?
That's right.
So, you know, they're amping things up straight away. But although it makes sense, some people would prefer like the because I think they do repeat the pattern then in three, although it's a long time before McLean even gets into any shootouts in three because he's running around the city so
That's
much.
right.
But then eventually you just get to like the one guy who can like beat him up. Where this movie is just like, no, they're all military guys. They could all kick his
That's
ass,
right.
theoretically. So,
There, but he doesn't get into fights with fist fights with many of them. That's the thing. You know. You know, we have now and then we have on the wing of the airplane. I don't think there's any other place where John gets into a fist fight with somebody, if I remember correctly. You know, he gets into shooting fights with them, but I don't know about fist fights. Unless you count it, oh, actually, unless you count you know, an icicle in the eye. Okay, there's
Oh
one.
yeah,
There is one there.
yeah. I'm really stunned that this movie managed to refrain from having McLean shoeless in the snow. It seems like there should have been a scene of that. Like, there should have been, like, well, he's not running, but he's going to have a shooting match in the snow. But this is the famous shoeless guy, right? This is shoeless John McClane. It's like, he was out without shoes that one movie, okay? But I'm really stunned that they, like, the amount of little beats they repeat, they're like, well, can we have one scene where he doesn't have shoes just for the sake of it? Like, no.
Well, I think John learned his lesson. I think that's what it comes down to.
You see, now if he pulls up his trouser leg, he's got, like, straps right up to his knee.
That's
like,
right.
He's like, these are never coming
off.
That's
right. This is my size.
Sock suspenders, all kind of crap. Like, every night, Holly's like, John, take off the shoes. Like, never, never.
Never again.
Lying in bed.
I did it once.
Lovely, still
I did it once, and I ended up stepping on glass. A lot of glass.
If he went, that'd be the thing if it was ever Die Hard in Japan. Oh, he'd be screwed. He's like, no, I can't go into anywhere now.
That's true. It's a good point. Very good point. And this is the point where we get the one piece of dialogue in this minute that you have stated that you hate, where John says, "What is this tag team?"
Yeah, maybe hate's a strong word. I think there's a lot of elements of, like, well, we have to repeat the tone of the first movie. And McClane was always wisecracking. This feels like it's – and you have the script, so maybe you can verify if this is true or not. It feels like this is an ADR thing where they were like, we need to have him say something funny here. Like, this was just a straight action scene. And they're like, we need it to be quippier because it's Die Hard. And a lot of the quips they come up with in this movie, I don't care for. Some of them are great. Some of them, not so much. Like, there's one later on with the one with the parachute.
Right.
Where he's like, where's the door? Like, I hate that.
No, he actually goes, where's the door?
yeah. But it's just such a kind of like, it's like a line from a kid's movie. And it's like, well, that is, it's many things. It's not a kid's movie. Like, I guess kids, I watched it when I was a kid, but it wasn't a kid's movie. This really strikes me as a thing of, like, them after the fact going, add a button here. Have a little thing. And then, well, what have we got? What can he say? Well, he already knows there's two of them. But he can say, well, this is a test. If he didn't know there was another guy there, then maybe I would accept it more. But he went in knowing he had to fight two guys. Right. And then suddenly be like, well, is this a tag team? It's like, it doesn't sparkle.
Right. Okay, that is completely fair. I mean, have you ever seen the movie The Last Boy Scout with Bruce Willis?
The last
scene in that movie is he's explaining to Jimmy, you know, Hallenbeck is explaining to Jimmy, and he goes, well, you know, you gotta be ready with the quips. You know, if you hit a guy with a surfboard, what are you going to say? And he goes, surf's up. And he goes, you're right. That's the way it is. So, you know, he's basically explaining in that movie, which comes out a year after this one, you know, why they need to have these quips in there. You know, we like that. They're fun. They're such fun having those quips.
Oh, no, but, like, the Last Boy Scout quips, they're so overwrought.
Yes.
That they're, like, to the point of being ridiculous, where I'm just like, oh, no, this is a whole different level.
Yes.
Like, I don't mind them being, like, terrible, because they're like, no, the whole movie, that's the tone.
Right.
He has so many great lines. And, like, I was just trying to think of any of them. It's like, there's so many. There's so many good lines in The Last Boy Scout.
Yes.
But all of them are very, like, arbitrarily set up to be like, well, this is going to be you have to have the goon say a thing that he can respond to. As you know, it's so kind of like, well, we're just here having fun.
That's right.
Has this real, like, oh, this would never happen. Whereas with Die Hard, it's kind of like, well, a guy might say that in this scenario.
True.
But the Last Boy Scout's like, no, no one would ever say that in these scenarios, because these scenarios would never happen because the whole movie is ridiculous.
That's true.
That's one of my major disappointment of watching when they try to make the Super Bowl a thing in, you know, over here. We knew what the Super Bowl was, but we never watched it because it was like, it's American football. But about 10 years ago, there was like a heavy promotion where, like, we are going to make the Super Bowl a thing outside of America. It's going to be big in England. It's going to be big in Ireland. And people watched it that night, and we were like, so bored. So it's like, oh my God, you stop the game? Like, every 5 seconds to reset the ball. What's going on? And my major disappointment was, like, I saw The Last Boy Scout. I was expecting it to be like pouring rain. And for guys that has been whipping out guns on the field and stuff, and none of that's happened. This is a horrific disappointment.
Yeah, but that's not professional baseball.
Friday night's a great night for football.
Yeah, Friday night's a great night for football. Yeah, I love that song.
I guess maybe it'd have to be like, well, it's Sunday. Maybe it'd have to alter the lyrics.
Right.
And if you're altering the vision, well, why play it at all?
That's right. There you go. And at this point, John jumps for cover on the conveyor belt. And, you know, we actually can see there a a like TV screen that has a list of flights. You know, it must be like arrivals or something like that. But again, why would they have that in there unless it's trying to tell people, you know, which conveyor belt has which, you know, which flight's luggage or something like that? I don't know.
It just, I gotta imagine you might need something like that in there.
No, but there's nobody like there's nobody in there.
Well, that's the thing. It would make more sense if the place had people in it.
That's right.
But as it is, it's like, well, like
it's not a populated
unseen robots doing this. That's or something, right. Or what
it's
is
not.
It?
It's populated by Miller and Cochran. That's who it's populated by. That's it.
Yeah. But in theory, though, I can imagine, like, yeah, you just have it there for, I don't know, maybe flights are running late or something.
Yeah, for sure.
You take the bags aside or something like that, maybe. But
could be. And then Cochran keeps shooting again, and the shots actually come quite close to John, but misses. So once again, you know, we saw a little bit earlier that Cochran is a great shot because he can shoot an aerosol can in someone's hand, but he can't actually get the larger target of the person. So
he might be like afterwards, he's actually not a great shot. He's like, could you believe I shot that freaking can? Like, I was like, I thought I was going to get anywhere near.
I was aiming for Miller.
I hate Miller so much. Like, I finally saw my chance. Damn it. If only I paid attention at the Colonel Stewart's target.
That's right. And then John seems to disappear. And then Cochran starts looking around for him. We see that he climbs up some stairs and starts looking around. And then we hear this banshee scream. And then we see John jump at him. And then we get the freeze frame to end this week.
Yeah. It's kind of like the I know he's doing a jump, but the way the clip ends, it almost looks as if he's just tripped and is falling off the thing. Because he has a look of panic on his face as well.
Yeah.
But it's much in context, it's much more dignified what he's doing. But and he's not quite that the Arnie yelp. Yeah.
And if you look at the exact 60-second mark here, you know, his eyes are like bulging out of his head as he's as he's screaming and jumping. it's a pretty funny shot. If I remember correctly, I'm gonna try and use that picture for the picture of this episode.
Oh, totally. It's a real thing, too. It's always a real treat in doing movies by Menace Treatment when you discover, like, where the minute cuts. And with something like that, you're like, oh, great.
Yes.
Like, it's always a joy.
Yeah.
Although you get the opposite end where you're, like, when you're enraptured in a scene and then the minute cuts. And you're like, oh, God,
that's right. It's like, especially if it's at the end of the week.
Yeah. I mean, this our upcoming season, Mask of the Phantasm, big iconic moment of Batman in the Batcave, but on the mask for the first time. Cuts as he's putting the mask on.
Oh, wow.
Annoying as all hell. But
yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, people don't make movies with us in mind, you know, about how they're going to, where they're going to cut their minutes.
No.
But, you know,
maybe someday.
We get back at them and we're able to still talk about it the way that they made the movie. You know, if a scene gets cut, we talk about it that way, you know. That's the way we do it.
I'm guessing you would have talked a bit about the actor playing Cochran, though, like in the
I spoke a little bit about him last week, but go ahead if you have anything to say about him.
No, the only big thing I was like, oh, it's that guy. Because originally when I was looking him up, I thought for a second, so I wasn't too sure of the character names. I thought it was they were saying on IMDb it was called Mark Boone Jr.
I'm waiting to come across him in this movie. I'm waiting for it.
Oh, that was a real thing too. I didn't even know he was in Die Hard 2. I was like, he's in this movie because he looks so different. I was like, holy Christ, that's him. But no,
it's not him. It's not him. He does appear here, and you know, I recently was on the a Memento minute, and I had him in that scene, and I was like, I can't believe that this is the same guy who was, you know, just 10 years earlier was in Die Hard, and he looks one way in Die Hard and then a completely different way in Memento.
Yeah, when he hits the 2000s, he kind of sticks to that look then, because he's in that, you know, he's in an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yeah. I remember he has that.
And also,
and he's in, of course, Batman again.
He's in, was it Sons of Anarchy? He plays a...
Yeah.
You know, and he looks the same. You know, for the last 23 years since Memento, he stayed the same. But, you know, I'm waiting for the opportunity to see where he is in this movie.
Because it was too that when they said
he plays Shockley.
His character name is Shockley. I was like, is he the guy who gets electrocuted? Is that the joke? And I was like, no, tragically not. Tragically not. But no, so this is John Costello. It was. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation. John Costello, Costelto, or something.
How did I pronounce it when I was last week? I think his John Costello.
Costello. So in my mind, I put an extra T in there. It's gone to Stelto. Is it?
No, I think it's John Costello.
No, but I mostly remember him. He's for his part in The Sopranos. Correct. He was because I'm a big Sopranos guy, and he was in the late season when the second to last season, I think, when one of the big story arcs was that one of the crew, Vito, they discovered that he was gay, and he was his partner was Cochran, you know, big handlebar mustache and stuff on him, and. Yeah, that was like, oh my God, that's who that guy is. Well, sort of the later day, one of the most iconic storylines from The Sopranos, where they highlight like, oh, by the way, all these gangster guys that you love, they're crazy homophobic.
Yeah,
they're horrible people. Just so you remember, like, oh yeah, no, I guess they're absolute, you know, trash people and stuff. But yeah, and spoilers, you know, things don't end so well for Vito because of it as well.
Yeah, that's true.
I know if you're a big Sopranos fan too, you know the guy played Vito went on to do. He's like a meme gold mine.
That's Joe Ganascoli.
Yeah. Apparently now he does like he's very egotistical about the fact that he was in The Sopranos, and he does like catered events where he cooks everything for you, but it's like $2,000.
Oh wow!
And the whole thing is like, you've got the honor of meeting this guy from The Sopranos, and you're like, you're not like. It's not like freaking Paulie Walnuts is cooking you dinner. Like it's like, oh, Vito, the guy from like season six. Like, I guess he was in The Sopranos. You know, it really would be like, well, am I meeting Lorraine Bracco or something? No, you're meeting some guy you might not even remember. But,
right.
But yeah, no. But the fair as an actor, he actually did great in that season. And yeah, it was, you know, actually ended up being a very sad storyline. But him and Cochran, John Costello. There's some great work together.
Yeah, so, I mean, I mentioned this last week. He was a firefighter for 11 years. While he was making this movie, he was a firefighter. And he worked with Steve Buscemi. The two of them were firefighters together.
Oh yeah,
and they were great friends.
It's weird because like this guy looks like a firefighter to me. Steve Buscemi has never looked like a firefighter.
Steve Buscemi doesn't even look like an actor. You know.
Yeah. But he looks like such a scrawny little guy. It's like you. Were they desperate for firefighters in New York? Like that guy did it, but apparently he's still like he's still tight with him. Like on occasion will pop by the firehouse and stuff. And
well, with who? Not with John.
With the firefighters.
Yeah, but not with John Costello, because John Costello unfortunately committed suicide in 2008.
Oh, the suicide! Oh, I seen that he died. I didn't see it was suicide.
Yeah,
he
shot himself, and so
Oh man. Yeah. That's another downside to the Movies by Minute stuff. Whereas when you start getting into the lesser sung actors,
yeah,
and you're like, oh, I can't wait to get into this guy's career, and then it's always a little thing of like, oh, well, they up to it. Oh no,
yeah, exactly.
And it's, you know, particularly when someone is like, well, he would have been like 40 something when he died. It's like, oh, that's
no he was way. Born in, he was born terrible. In 61 and he died in 2008, so he was 48.
Yeah, for 40, 48, 47 thereabouts. Yeah.
No, it was 48. Yeah, it was a month after his 48th birthday. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's it's just really, it's always just like a real, like, oh, I can't wait to get into the.
Well, no, I had a similar thing. I was, you know, sending out messages to all these minor characters in the movie, you know, trying to you know, telling them what I'm doing and hoping that somebody will respond to me. And then I get to him and I'm like, oh, cool. I'll be able to contact Cochran. And then I saw that he passed away, and I was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to get in touch with him.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there is always the Ouija board, but how reliable are they, quite frankly?
Yeah.
Terrible reception over Skype as well, I understand.
Yeah, I don't really know how it'll be a little more difficult to interview someone that way.
Yeah. That's weirdly enough, on Batman, we've not had that many big deaths, because like, a lot of the people who were in those main Batman movies, nearly all of them are still going.
Well,
like Jack Nicholson's still going, friggin' Keaton's still going, Danny DeVito, Michelle Pfeiffer, like all the big stars are all still.
Yeah, but Michael Goh has passed away.
Yeah, him and Pat Hingle both Hingle. Gone. But exactly. they you know, Michael Gaw kind of looked like he was ready to die in 89, quite frankly.
Well, he almost did in Batman and Robin. So, I'm sure you know about this, the goof where he moves in Batman Forever, you know, after he gets knocked out by I always love watching that. You just seem like just like move over. It's like you missed your mark.
but the sad thing, the Mask of the Phantasm though, is like it's mired in death. It's like it's even then too when we were getting ready to start recording, it was like around the time Kevin Conroy died, and I'm like, oh my god, now the whole season has like kind of tinge of tragedy. It's like Abe Vigoda and friggin' Dick Miller, like freaking all of these guys, like, yeah, they're all dead. It's just like, oh, it's a bit of a bummer. But it catches up with all of us. Like,
that's true. It's the one thing we can't get away from. But that was also why with The Great Escape, when they did The Great Escape, everyone is dead there. There are three. There were three actors that were still alive, and I actually got to interview one of them. So it was great.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And this dude, like Richard Attenborough, as if he wasn't hanging on. Like, that guy was around for a while.
Well, Richard Attenborough, he died about 10 years ago, and he was suffering from Alzheimer's for a few years. So, you know, that wouldn't have helped anyway. But
this is always so weird that you see, like, because over here you still get, you know, Brighton Rock still pops up on TV all the time, and seeing him is like, oh yeah, little Dickie Attenborough. Right. They always call him back then. It's like, you mean that crusty old guy from Jurassic Park? Like, yes, he was once a young man. Somehow.
Well,
somehow
we actually had a debate at one point if it's possible that that the character in Jurassic Park is actually a clone of Big X.
Ah. I think you're going to say, like, the clone of the character from Brighton Rock. It's like, yeah, he escaped, and then he somehow made his millions and cloned himself and became the owner of Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Nope.
No.
Not at all. Okay, so you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
No, I think that's,
this minute script is entirely description, for obvious reasons. So it you know, we ended things with the script yesterday talking about that John sees a pair of skis, and then it says Miller moves forward expertly, gun ready, whap, a ski pole smacks down on his wrist. The gun drops onto a conveyor belt, fires, then moves away, obscured by moving luggage. Now, again, my biggest question would be is why would they write that he's going to, you know, hit him in the hand with the skis instead of hitting him in the face? I don't know. McLean's.
At this, I don't know, maybe he just wants, maybe he's like, I killed so many guys in Nakatomi, I just want to be able to arrest them. Or maybe he just wants information. He's like, I don't want to risk killing them, so I'll just hit him in the hands, at least just to make sure he's disarmed, and then it can be like a fair fight, I guess.
Okay, that makes sense. So then it says McLean steps in, punches Miller, gets hit hard himself. Both roll over onto the new conveyor belt. Cochran, hearing the shot, tries to pinpoint the location, but with all the echoes, it's very hard. McLean and Miller continue to fight hand in hand. Miller starts pressing the ski pole against McLean's throat. McLean tries to do the same thing back. They spin, smash into a pile of suitcases, some of which spill open. Miller gets in a powerful punch, gets free. The camera follows Miller as his hand gropes for the pistol, and then McLean rolls into view with hairspray right in the guy's eyes. Miller howls, blinded. But then, blam, a bullet explodes the can in McLean's hand. Cochran is there. McLean leaps like Tarzan to the bottom of the higher empty return belt. The momentum swings him right towards Cochran. So you were completely right. The phrase of, what is this, tag team is 80 yard in.
Yeah.
It's not.
I'm willing to bet that parachute line's added in after, too. I'll be willing to put money down on that. So I'll be listening to that episode to see if I'm right.
All right. Well, I hope you listen to all episodes, not just the episodes, you know, that you want to try and find. If it was ADR, then,
I'll listen to that one twice.
There you go. There you go.
Just to revel in my rightness, I guess.
Okay. Great. Good luck with that. I'll have to try and remember when I record it to mention it to you.
Wait. But I'm actually surprised, though, considering we've got the Tiger Shark product placement in. I'm surprised no hair care company stepped up to be like, do you want to be the hairspray that saves John McClane's life, like L'Oreal or someone getting in. You get like a body form.
But you do need to take into consideration that it explodes, so it gets destroyed. So I don't know if someone wants that as a product placement.
I don't know. It's still doing the Lord's work, you know. Like right. It's still saving the day. So. Okay. They're like, well, it was blown up by bad people, so you know,
that's true.
But it went out in a blaze of glory. Although, also, kind of, if it was like Die Hard 5, there's no way that can would have like blown up. It'd be like, you know, it gets shot in a very realistic fashion in this. I can imagine in later action movies there'll be like a ball of flame or something, because it's like, oh, they're flammable, right? So of course it's gonna like properly explode in his hand.
That's right.
But
I don't know why they didn't do that. All right, so every Friday I have a segment called Where Are They Up To This Weekend, where I basically test my guest about some of their favorite movies.
Okay.
So since you've done the Batman, so you've done the four Batman movies from the late 80s, early 90s, Batman, Batman Returns, Batman Forever, and Batman and Robin. So I want you to try and, you know, go back in time and think, you know, what is happening in each of these movies, you know, at the end of the third week, beginning of the fourth week, you know, between minutes 15 and 16.
Oh, okay. So that's the thing. I could almost verify each, because I've got the...
No, but I don't want you to look it up. I want to see if you know it from memory.
Oh, no, I'll pause it, I guess, and then see if I'm right.
I can tell you. I'll be able to tell you if you're right. I looked it up myself also, obviously.
Oh, okay. Oh, God. You thought ahead.
Of course, I've thought ahead.
You've organized the show ahead of time.
Mm,
I say week three of Batman.
The end of week three.
That would be
the end of week three. Again, we're talking the cusp between week three and week four.
Week three and week four, because Batman, the first week was all credits. I remember that. So it'll be then end of week three. I'd say it'll be probably near enough around the time of What Are You? I'm Batman. That feels about right to me. I feel there's a solid week of credits. Then there's all the setup of the family wandering around. And then week three, you'd get Batman actually like, or maybe it wouldn't even be that far. It might even just be like him descending behind them. Like the really cool shot of them sitting huddled and talking about like Johnny Gobbs and stuff. And then seeing the silhouette coming down behind them. So I'd say that's about the end of week three. If I had to hazard a guess.
Okay. Well, you are unfortunately incorrect based on my research.
Wait a minute. I think there's a mix up here now, because we do it 3 minutes. We do 3 minutes a week. So the end of week three for us would be like minute nine.
Okay.
So minute 15, where that would probably be like, you'd be into like Eckhart and Knox thereabouts, I'd imagine. Something around there, I'd say.
No, Eckhart and Knox are actually a little before that also. Eckhart and Knox are basically the minute that I'm referring to, between minutes 15 and 16, is you have Grissom in his office with all of his goons, you know, telling them that he's starting to get nervous about Harvey Dent. And then Jack gives him the idea and says to him that we should go trash the office.
Yeah, that's, you know, get someone else to do this. There's fumes in that place.
There you go.
Oh, great. Oh, I love that. I think that's still, it's weird, my roundabout journey with the Batman movies, going from like, you know, the such hardcore and like, oh, The Dark Knight's the greatest movie ever made back in like 2008 and stuff. And have like, after doing like five seasons now, I've been like, I think that 89 movie is still the best. I think they nailed it so well in that first film. But of course, great Jack Palance. It was such a joy to be able to talk about him back then, too. It was one of those ones, too. Like, you get, like him, we got so involved in the character of Eckhart as well, that when he died, it was genuinely like emotional for us. Like, oh, he's not in the rest of the film now. We have to stop talking about
him. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. All right, so let's move along to Batman Returns. What do you think happens?
Okay.
Between minute 15 and 16.
Minute 15 and 16 of Batman Returns would be... That's good. That'll be mid-Red Triangle circus attack.
Very good.
That's like... That takes up a good chunk of the start,
that's,
I think.
Right. So. It's the you know, Batman fighting with the circus freaks.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yes, you got that one right. Great. Okay, let's move on to Batman Forever. What's happening between minutes 15 and 16?
Batman Forever, I would posit, is probably around the time when the safe is dangling from the helicopter? Because I feel Batman Forever gets into things a lot faster. It starts with a big, and then there's a skirmish. I'd say it'd be 15-16. I'd say you're probably, yeah, the Two-Face hauling out that giant safe and dangling it above the city from the helicopter. That strikes me as being right.
Nope, you got that one wrong. I'm so sorry. Is when Enigma meets Wayne and shows him his adventure.
Oh wow. Okay, well, so they really got things out of the way early in that movie, because I thought that, like, oh, it's like 20 minutes of solid action. It's like, no, the action is done at that point. But,
yeah. All right, and for the final one, Batman and Robin.
Batman and Robin's probably like the first to be the introduction of Pamela Isley. Like, it'll be going off or seeing like John Glover, Jason Woodrue, and all the craziness happening in the jungle. I imagine. I think that's because it follows the formula of Batman Forever so strictly that it's kind of like repeating a lot of the same beats. So it would not be surprising. Like, well, we met Edward Nygma, and then it's, you know, Nygma and Bruce Wayne met in, minute 15, 16 of Forever. So you're meeting basically the kind of new version of that with, you know, Pamela Isley.
All right. And, you are really, really close on that one. So I'm going to give you that one because it's. The end of 15 is where Batman has to defrost Robin. And then the beginning of 16 is where we're introduced to Poison Ivy, where her experiment fails.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'll give you this. That's not bad. You got 2 out of 4. That's pretty good.
No, that was me quoting a minute. Because the first time you see her, she goes, curses.
Oops.
The first time you see her and the last time you see her. She both says the same thing. It's almost as if they try to do a little mirror image thing of her. But the thing is, though, we still have no idea how Poison Ivy is defeated in that movie. Like, if you, I don't know,
watched all 4 of them this week in order to be prepared to talk about it with you. So yes, I've rewatched all 4, nice. And I reviewed all 4 also. You can even go online and check my website and see new reviews of all 4 of them.
What was your favorite of the 4?
By far. It's always a big debate. There's a very, very big gap between the first one and the second one, even.
Oh.
You know, and I saw all 4 of them in the theater.
Love Batman Returns so much, but.
You know. But I still remember all the hype in 89, you know, when Batman came out. And to me, that and the original Superman is what led the groundwork for MCU, you know. There's no question about totally. That because those are the, you know, and it's ironic that those are both DC movies. Yeah. You know, I'm a bigger DC fan than Marvel.
I think I have to say the same thing happens to me with, and it still didn't fade after reviewing it for like 120, you know, episodes, is that like I was 8 when Batman Forever came out. And so every time I see a single image from that movie, which is a very flawed movie, and we had tons of people coming on that season going like, this film is garbage. And I was like, no.
Okay, I wouldn't say it's the greatest film I've ever made, and I wouldn't say it's garbage. It's somewhere in the middle.
No, but I'm just so like, the imagery of just like, yeah, that the bat symbol with a question mark around it, and just like the U2 song and stuff is all like.
No, there's definitely some great stuff in Batman Forever. The thing I didn't like that Schumacher did was the whole idea of the colors. The color schemes, which you know, there's so many different flashing, you know, rainbow colors all around, and I just find that really strange. I mean, that's obviously his version of Gotham. That's what happens in Gotham. I understand that, but I found it distracting.
Oh no, I'm 100% on board with his, like, because it's weird if you go and watch some of Flatliners. There's images in the city in Flatliners like that's right. Schumacher's Gotham. He already did it beforehand, so you can kind of see like the through line of like, oh, this guy, maybe, you know, right. Maybe he could do this kind of thing. But yeah, there's some weird ones as well. Like if you look up and you even get it on IMDb, there's like early you know, pictures of Tommy Lee Jones's Two-Face makeup, but they went a darker shade, and he looks so much more gruesome. Like when they just turn it to like a dark red. And it's like, holy crap, oh my god, it looks hideous. And then when they're like, no, let's go bright pink. And then suddenly it just goes, no, oh, it just kind of looks kind of stupid now. but it was, for Schumacher, particularly that first movie, is a really delicate balancing act of trying to figure out when he was going too dark and when he was going too light. And then I always maintain from that season, because I read along with it, the Peter David novelization, where he kind of basically tries to fix the movie, but he doesn't have to do all that much. He doesn't have to take all that. He just keeps things that were cut from the script, and he adds in a few little bits and bobs. And that's the best version of Batman Forever, is that novelization. And you see, like, what a movie it could have been. Had, like, you know, they just been like, I mean, even like all the talk of the Schumacher cut, people are dying to get this recut version of it out, because there's so much stuff in it that's like, they should have taken that out. That's fantastic.
Do you think they ever will have a Schumacher cut, even though he's no longer with us?
I think that the campaign's hot enough that I can imagine James Gunn been like, yeah, maybe, you know, there's money to be made there. Why not do a Blu-ray or a, you know, streaming release of it? Weird thing is, you can actually essentially get the Schumacher cut already. If you go online, there's fans put it together as the assembly cut. You can get, like, because all the deleted scenes, a lot of them are just around. You can just find them. So people will put in the Two-Face's, you know, the dark escape from Arkham that's supposed to be at the beginning of the movie. They've re-edited it so the events occur the way they do in the script and stuff. And so that, you know, that's a great version of the film. It's just that the novelization, like, it does things like it gives Chase Meridian, you know, Nicole Kidman's character, like a bit more of, it makes her out to be less of an idiot, basically, because the movie's really like, oh, she's just this crazed horn dog who's friggin' dripping for Batman the whole time, and she can never piece together that Batman is Bruce Wayne until it's way too late. Whereas in the novelization, she knows immediately the Batman's Bruce Wayne, and she's in this kind of like little, she kind of, not that they're making her villainous, but she has a whole thing where she's like, I want to see how far I can take this. Like, I'll continue to go out with Bruce Wayne and continue to flirt with Batman, and I want to see what will happen. Because she's a psychiatrist, she's like, well, this is a completely unique psychological experiment to have a guy who's got such the distinct split personality disorder going on, and then to see how far I can run it. And eventually then she just, you know, ends up regretting everything and burns all her tapes because she's so emotionally involved and all those kind of things. But I had to recommend anything for anybody. I was like, hunt down the Peter David novelization of Batman Forever, and then just go with that, because when you're reading that, you can imagine a much better performance for Two-Face than Tommy Lee Jones and his handing it the hell up. You can tone down Jim Carrey in your mind if you want to a little bit, and you can make a really good Batman movie out of that, and then just keep all the cool visual stuff of the posters and the soundtrack and all that stuff, and just play it in your mind.
Oh wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that. Thank you very much for suggesting that. I will see if I can try and find a copy of that novelization.
I think it's like I got it very easy. It's like eBay for like $3 or something like that. Well, $3 over here, but like, yeah, it's not one that's like, you know, difficult to track down or anything. I believe you can also get it on YouTube, but it's the audiobook version as read by René Auberjonois. So, you know, Dr. Burton himself in the movie, and of course, you know, friggin' Odo and stuff from from Star Trek.
Yeah, very cool. All right, so Niall, you want to, for one last time this week, tell people where they can find you?
Well, yep, you can hear more from me, of course, at Bat Minute, which is a podcast where we analyze all the Batman movies minute by minute. And we've got 4 seasons done, so like all the live-action ones from the 80s/90s are done, and we will be launching, actually by the time this episode airs, we will be mid-Mask of the Phantasm, that will have started airing, which is a weird one because it's such a shorter movie. We're so used to being like, okay, we got 120 episodes to fill, and this is like, you got 77. You're like, we're nearly done. So, we've only basically cracked into it, and it feels like we're nearly done already. But beyond that, of course, you can also hear me on Miami Minutes, where we're breaking down the 1987 Kung Fu biker friendship love affair classic Miami Connection. 1 minute at a time as well. Once a week, me and my co-host John. And yeah, on both shows, we have a great time. Miami Minutes is much more of a lackadaisical, we're just messing around, we're just goofing kind of show, whereas Batman, we do try to have a bit more of, like, you know, a bit it's a bit more infotainment, where we're trying to, you know, hoping you'll learn something about something as you listen as well, but not in like a boring way. We hope it's, you know, we're still there just having fun too. So And yeah. So you, both shows are readily available on all good podcatchers. And by just typing in their names to Google, it should come up pretty quickly, I'd imagine.
All right. Excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, or you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, Niall, thank you very much for joining me this week. I had a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. It was a great time. Like, I'm always happy to talk about anything, but particularly Die Hard, because, like, who doesn't like talking about Die Hard, quite frankly?
That is true. That is true. I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
So thank you, and I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, have a great weekend, and yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages,